Really, I'm going to ask all of our speakers just to join us up here on the stage. We might require, excuse me, a third chair. Because we've got a few minutes now for, thank you, Ivan. We've got a few minutes now for discussion. And I think we're also very happy to open it up to all of you in the room. So we're happy to, excuse me, we are happy to pass the microphone around. But if I could ask the three of you, thank you very much to join us up here. Because I think it would be interesting to know what brings a group of people together around solitary pleasures today and why perhaps it's a topic worth pursuing right now. So Mark, just to kind of give a quick overview, thank you, Mark, for introducing both yourself and also some of the thinking behind the Solitary Pleasures exhibition that's now on at the Freud Museum. And what you didn't mention, perhaps, is worth knowing, is Mark recently published a book titled The Erotic Doll, A Postmodern Fetish. And I have a feeling that a lot of the ideas, it was a real kind of critique of heterosexual masculinity, and I think a lot of the ideas, thank you, please let me know if you can't hear me. Can you hear me now? Is that good? Thank you. A lot of the ideas stemming from that publication seem to have, to use the word, infected the exhibition and thinking today. But Mark also talked about kind of starting with the now and talking about predatory forms of masturbation. And he used the word affirmative, and the word inclusive has been used a lot around thinking about this exhibition. And I wonder if those kinds of ideas are going to be teased out today. David, as we know, spoke about the money in masturbation. He gave us a fantastic kind of journey through the history of onanism. He referenced self-pollution. He discussed masturbation as an act of suicide and really circulating around this currency of desire and perhaps what it means, what a wasteful act means in this context, and perhaps what the value is of the wasteless act. And I think that would be something we could perhaps also discuss. And Milia, thank you for that beautifully evocative tale that took us through waiting and desire and frustration and denial and glaring vulvas, which was a fantastic line. But also the idea that it can happen any time and anywhere. And there's that sense of it being out of control. And this sense of, I think, control, it seems to be bound up with all of the speakers. So that's my little brief summation. Are you happy for me to hand it over to the... would anybody like to open up with questions? Because I'm quite curious about... I think it's really fantastic that we've got such a big group of people here today. Who'd like to kick us off? It's always hard to start. Oh, it's silent.
Get extra cookies for starting.
Thank you very much. Well done.
I wasn't sure how to formulate this question, but seeing as no one else is speaking up, I'll just spit it out. I suppose I was thinking it originally came from when David was speaking about it. Something struck me about the history around imagination and masturbation, and how what was fearful was that it was coming from one's own fantasies and conjuring up from your own head. And it's interesting that now so much of masturbation is wrapped up around pornography and sort of curated outside one's own, you know, what comes from your own experiences and your own. I don't know if you've had any thoughts at all about how the relationship between imagination and masturbation has sort of had to change by the very nature of how inundated we are by a constant stream of pornographic and sexual imagery in our lives.
I think the development of what I call the epidemic of masturbation phobia, which develops in the early 18th century, it's overdetermined. There are multiple influences obviously involved in it, but one of them is the huge increase in the availability of pictorial pornography, particularly coming from France toward the end of the 17th century. And as I try to suggest, that pamphlet that kicks off the whole epidemic of anxiety about masturbation was marketed as kind of soft porn, and that, you know, readers will be shocked and horrified to discover that mode I'm thinking about the habit of 19th century physicians, some 19th century physicians, of keeping the passages of their sexual advice manuals about masturbation in Latin, so they're only available to the profession rather than to the vulgar to read. But there's no doubt, I mean, it's been said many times before, these self-help manuals are aptly named because these hygiene manuals are aptly named as self-help manuals because they were used as pornography, basically, by masturbators. So, I think one of the things that has changed, obviously, is that it used to be said the difference between erotica and pornography was the height of the shelf. Erotica was middle-class art, pornography was working-class pornography. With the universal availability of pornography through the internet, you know, I'll go to put on the dirty raincoat and go to the sex shop and mumble, has come a new kind of acceptance or sort of respectability for it, to the extent that we're told that our sub-teen children are can't see themselves except through the filter of pornographic imagery and forever taking photographs of themselves and each other and posting them online under their parents' noses. So obviously it's changed, but I think the association between, obviously, between pornography from Pompeii onwards, between pornography and masturbation is unbreakable. Sorry, I'm rambling now.
One of the reasons why I wanted to start to write this novel was, in fact, because my daughters will grow up, and they are very fast growing up, and they have found themselves in the internet and seen imagery that has shocked them and that has put them very not at ease at all. They're very scared of the images and that they've seen, and at the same time they're curious about their bodies and they're curious about their sexuality, and there is a whole generation that is growing that has maybe no use for erotica at all. I don't write erotica per se, but I write about as we can see, this is not a taboo, so many of you are here, but when I mentioned that I'm coming to London to this masturbation conference, all I got was this giggles and people could not even look me in the eye and talk about it. So it means it's still a taboo. It's still very much of a taboo. And in the book,
you neglected to mention you're coming from a very small village in the southwest of France.
That too. But even people that I, my publishers, and they were like, "Whoa, oh my goodness!" So it's I'd really like to have the chance to show through this writing why imagination is so vital to masturbation. It really makes you evolve into a whole being, and your sexuality has its own imagery that is shared with nobody else, and it's fantastic.
Mm. And I wonder the I wonder about the extent to which the imagination is being colonized by the pornographic. There's a lack of imagination. I'm speaking quite loudly because I don't have a microphone. Is it loudly enough? Yeah? Okay. You used the phrase constant stream, which made me think about one of the works in the exhibition. So we've got a whole load of documentation and film from Shannon Bell, who's been working since the 80s as an activist. Thank you very much. Around issues of female masturbation, and you know, one of a number of people in North America and elsewhere that have been very committed to kind of, you know, developing a more public debate around female masturbation, which doesn't get talked about at all, and which, you know, a friend who came to the exhibition's opening last week said it would have been incredibly useful to have known more about this when he was growing up, because he'd have spent his whole time trying to please any and every woman he was near as a way of just, you know, getting that money shot. You know, of course, now female masturbation or
performances of it or versions of it or simulations of it are an integral part of mainstream pornography. And, you know, one has to wonder whether that mainstreaming is a democratization of the practice or whether it's just yet another, you know, form of, I mean, a heteronormative sexual practice, which just happens to look vaguely similar to the kinds of interests that, you know, a lot of feminist activists from the 80s onwards were trying to peddle. I don't think they're the same thing. And even if they are, they certainly don't exist within the same set of discourses. And I think, if anything, they're probably, as you were suggesting, evidence of, you know, an ongoing kind of withering of the imagination.
Thank you. We've got a question over here.
I'm the only one with the mic. Yeah. I'm just wondering, I mean, that that idea of feminists peddling ideas, I think, is an interesting one. But we perhaps ought to open up a bit, because the language is particular. And I just, I'm an artist myself, and I'm obviously very preoccupied with the imagination. I've just done a series of works on daydreaming, and as a kind of last bastion of a space that we hold, which I think is activated during masturbation. It has to be, actually. It is a place that no one else can invade, take over at that point. But this whole thing of pornography, I mean, over the last 30 years or so, we have had a revisiting of the word pornography and an exposure of almost the, well, absolutely the commodification of sex. And as a most particular human place that is, you know, nothing cannot be appropriated by capitalism. Everything's up for grabs. But perhaps we need a bit more of a sophisticated approach towards this word pornography, because, of course, many things that might have been deemed pornographic in the past are actually about this whole emphasis on shame. We bring in class, we bring in gender around manifestations of our own sexuality. And I don't know if that sort of binary polarization of this idea of erotica here and pornography here is helpful. Perhaps it might be good to bring in this idea of agency and this relationship between self and other in agency over our sexuality and our abilities to frame that ourselves. And of course, young people, just as older people, are constantly revisiting their own definitions of self and agency, and are at the process in their lives of rich experimentation. So maybe some of those things can come into the discourse.
Yes.
Look, obviously the commodification of sex is nothing new at all. As I mentioned, one of the things I did in my book was to trace the use of monetary terms for sexual organs, activities and relationships, which is a development that really explodes in the 18th, early 19th century, particularly during the Industrial Revolution. The number of different terms for the penis, the vagina, bank, purse, coin, etc., is extraordinary, much, much broader than is used in slang these days. And obviously the commodification of sex precedes the development of capitalism in Europe in the 18th century. So this notion that there was a moment of purity, there was an Eden before what, I don't know, multinationals or something, seems to me a myth to be avoided. There's also the question of what the imagination does with images. In the 18th century, fear was that the imagination was the enemy of reason. In the age of reason, of course, it had to be treated suspiciously in and of itself. But a lot of masturbatory fantasies, so I'm told, evolved memory as much as invention or the use of pictures. There are complicated processes going on, which maybe, I don't know, neuroscience can interestingly tell us about. I'm not quite sure what you were wanting to say about what might be a specifically aesthetic use of the imagination, or whether the art gallery, the art space, demands a different sort of attention, a non-pornographic attention to explicit sexual images. One of the definitions of pornography is anything that is meant or used to as an accompaniment to masturbation. So things can be pornographic for you, but not for me, or they can be pornographic today, but not pornographic tomorrow. They can be a medical textbook for sexologists, or pornography for sexologists too. Do you think?
No, it's not a question, it's a comment, but very much relates to what you just said. My reaction to what I heard earlier was exactly that I would like to defend imagination as being part of a solitary pleasure, regardless of whether pornography is part of it. It might have to do with memories, have to do with other things that are being evoked, nothing to do with necessarily a visual image or anything that you are exposed to physically. So let's just separate the two things. Pornography is not necessarily or doesn't have to be part of any solitary pleasure. I wonder, though, whether this is different from a female as opposed to a male perspective. I'm just wondering.
And what makes certain things turn on certain people and for others it's completely off? So that's where it becomes interesting. This is where our imagery becomes part of ourselves and who we are. And so if we rely on solely on pornographic images, then again, one might ask, what makes us go look at certain images and not certain images? So it's all part of who we are. Maybe it has something to do with our memories once again. But to explore any and every possible thing to make the imagination work as hard as possible, and to make us understand our sexuality more and more, and to make us really, and maybe that's one of the as you were talking about, the more educated a woman is, the more she masturbates, or maybe in the early days it was supposed to be the same way as well, as was the higher classes who were supposed to masturbate because they had more time on their hands. But
One explanation of why insanity is deemed to be a consequence of masturbation was because the inmates of insane asylums were regularly observed masturbating because they were idle, bored, and disinhibited. similar to what you were saying.
Yes.
It's a virtuous circle.
Thank you. I just wanted to make a clarification around Shannon Bell and her work. I worked with Shannon many years ago and invited her to speak to a large audience, whereupon she opened her talk by ejaculating all over the audience. And I want to, and they were a little surprised. They came to hear a masturbation session but not see it or feel it or wear it. And I wanted to just indicate, because I've heard it a couple of times now, or more than a couple of times, this thing called women's masturbation, which conjures up in my mind some sort of, I don't know, non-messy, non-ejaculatory, I don't know, sort of soft porn look. And I just wanted to say that there is a whole other side that keeps getting, I don't know, hidden. Women, men, trans, radical fairies, whatever this genitalia may or may not expose, comes in very different packages and ways. And Shannon Bell in particular tried to herald not masturbation, but women's ejaculation.
Yeah. Sorry, female ejaculation.
That's okay.
Female masturbation.
Mm. No, I'm just sensitive to this, seeing I wasn't in the audience and wouldn't have minded have been.
Apologies. No, the point was that we have a film of her work, which is all about sex education and female ejaculation, which in the late 80s and early 90s was part of an effort to try to educate which has become part of mainstream straight pornography. And I was simply suggesting that when men are online watching female ejaculation, they aren't necessarily caring one way or the other about the history of the development of sex education, and it's happily been absorbed into pornography's kind of relentless colonization and capitalization of all forms of sex, however minoritarian
women's pornography. It's also gone in, it's not just men that consume pornography.
And the same thing when you have these surveys and what are your fantasies in women's magazines and men, I bet in science as well. And a lot of time you see women saying, well, I'd like to make love on a beach and da 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 da. I wonder how many of these times does the woman say something that she's supposed to say, that we expect her, and that something erotic and something tender as opposed to raw and sexual and private. And I think a lot of us, and maybe or maybe all of us, we have this hidden thing we will not reveal to one person. And that is the beauty. That's the beauty of it. It's really supposed to be our personal. It comes from a deep core of who we are. And it's supposed to remain that way. We're not supposed to maybe share it like this. We can talk about it. But it is really an essential part of who we are.
Thank you, and thank you. This is Professor Johnny Golding, who will be speaking in a session later this morning, I believe. And who is a philosopher and artist and my colleague, senior research tutor at the Royal College of Art. I think that we're nearing towards, we need to have a little break now before session number two, but I hope that we can continue some of these questions, especially those around taboo and the role of women within this, later this morning. So thank you very much for our first panel, and I believe we have some coffee outside.
Yeah.